Conversation about 2020 presidential politics and your vote. Joining me now is Ravi Perry, chair of the Department of Political Science with Howard University. Lines are open if you have a comment or question about this issue, particularly as it relates to what Stacey Abrams shared with us in the first half of the program. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Zero. Dr. Perry, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to be with you.
So let's begin to dissect this conversation that we just heard with Stacey Abrams. First of all, did she make the case for vice president in your mind?
Well, she certainly made the case that she is qualified for the role of vice president, right? She articulated her experience in the state legislature leadership there in Georgia, where she was minority leader. And she, of course, talked about her leadership in both running small businesses and large nonprofits. And so she tried to communicate that she certainly is skilled enough that she can not only articulate what it is that is deeply and pervasively challenges the United States at this particular moment, but that if called to serve, she, of course, would be ready. But she also was careful to acknowledge that ultimately, as she believes, Joe Biden will be the next president, and that whomever he chooses, since particularly he's been vice president before, she will support.
You know, qualifications aside, and obviously, as you just laid out, she is extremely qualified. But how important is likability? As you know, it has been said that's why Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election, because voters did not like her. Is that an unfair burden to bear for any politician, and particularly women?
Oh, well, certainly it's an unfair burden for women in particular. The fact that we attach likability, looks, appearance, tone of voice, hair texture, weight, all these types of preconditions onto the legitimacy of someone who is seeking our potential votes for public office, it's really a sad commentary on the state of women in politics in America today, and how our American political system and all of us who engage in it are in many ways complicit in furthering that narrative. That notwithstanding, the reality is that it's been women who have been largely the backbone of the Democratic Party, of which Stacey Abrams is a member. And so the likability factor, one could argue, even if it is something that some say is a factor worth considering, when it relates to women in politics, because they also are the largest voting base in politics, perhaps the likability factor is less of a concern, because the shared experience between women perhaps helps them to better understand each other's perspective.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about 2020 presidential politics and your vote. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Let's go to Yvonne calling from Bowie. Yvonne, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mr. Fisher. I hope you're doing well.
I most certainly am. Yes, indeed. What's on your mind?
That's great to hear. I was listening to your conversation with Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
And, you know, she was saying, you know, we have to get out and vote and march, and the march is good and all of that, so the African-American and the other Latinos and of color.
Mm-hmm.
You see, one thing I have a problem with.
What's that?
I have a problem with how Joe Biden treated Anita Hill. I have a problem with that. I do. I have a problem with giving him my vote. I do. I'm going to have to pray on that because he would have treated me the same way.
Hmm. So let me ask you this, and then I'll have Dr. Perry chime in. If given a choice between Joe Biden and your concerns about him treating, how he treated Anita Hill during the confirmation hearings of now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and the discussions about how Donald Trump has treated women, what is your conundrum?
I would not vote for Donald Trump, period. He is not even worth being in the conversation. I would have to pray very hard because I am going to vote because my ancestors died and shed blood for me to vote. So I am going to vote. And I would vote for Joe Biden, but it would be very hard for me to do. I'm honest.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And then when all the black politicians, you know, they get on and they make all these promises and we're going to reform criminal justice and we're going to do this. And when you call their office, they don't even return your phone call.
Well, let me stop you there, Yvonne, and let me see what Dr. Perry has to say, because Dr. Perry, she has brought up two critical issues. One, that she has questions about, you know, the presumptive Democratic nominee, as well as, and she says she's not going to vote for Donald Trump. What are you hearing there?
Well, I hear reticence, and reticence is perfectly understandable for any candidate. I mean, ultimately, unless we are running ourselves, we are likely going to have some reticence about somebody. That is not something that I think is in any way unusual and should in no way be disparaged. But one thing that I do want to encourage is that as African Americans, as people who had to fight first for freedom, of negative freedom, just to be able to walk around and without shackles and without, you know, having to hold papers. And then for those same people who, you know, fought for humanity, then fought for citizenship, and then fought for the right to vote, as Yvonne was indicating, you know, we do have, I think, an obligation to respect the really the trail of tears and blood and sweat and lives of our ancestors that gave us the opportunity to be sitting here today and even having a conversation about being participating in this American democratic experiment through this opportunity we have that we call voting. And I think it's important for us to then not only take advantage of the franchise because it's been given to us, but to use that advantage to our advantage. And that requires us to think about when we go into those voting booths, not just what's best for you as an individual. Think about what's best for other people whom you care about, what's best for other people in your shared group or identity. For me, it may be thinking about not just what's good for me as an individual, what's good for other African Americans. What's the most responsible choice here for other LGBTQ Americans? What's the responsible choice here for those people who simply believe in providing the opportunity for more people to participate in elections than less? Right? So if you believe in any of these types of ideologies or ideas, then I think it actually becomes a bit more clear about our civic duty. Voting is a civic responsibility. It's our citizenship responsibility, and we fought for that right. People died for their right for citizenship, and so for us to abandon the most sacred opportunity to exercise that right where it counts, as Stacey Abrams was saying in the interview, if we don't actually make our voices heard, then we are simply not counted. And I do think when in a two-party system, now end with this, where you have one option on the one hand and one option on the other hand, of which to make your vote to have the most power that it can possibly have. When you have one or two options, you may, by your head, you may begrudgingly pull that lever for that option that you may consider the lesser of two evils or what have you. But I would encourage you to think about it differently. We're not making a lesser of two evils decision. We're making the decision that's in the best group interest of the people whom we care about most.
Yvonne, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about 2020 presidential politics and your right to vote. One of the things that Stacey Abrams said that was striking to me, she was talking about voter suppression, what she called the attack on the right to vote. And paraphrasing here, relying on the goodwill of others who do not feel our pain. Can you break that down for us?
Oh, wow, yes. So the reality is when you are a minority in this country, it is going to require effective coalition building with other groups in the majority in order to get the kinds of changes you need as a minority to be reflected in the documents that are allegedly supposed to be representing all of us. And since we live in a country where our founding documents, still enshrined since 1776, since 1789, the ratification of the Constitution, enshrined directly and indirectly to the exclusion of African Americans, of Native Americans, of women, of white men that did not own property, of all black men from the right to vote, so on and so forth. All these things that had to be fixed in amendments, and all these things that had to be fought through wars and through the pain and anguish of movement building and lives lost, is that ultimately that work is worth it. Because it engenders in us is an American spirit that, yes, it forces us to recognize as minorities that we have to work with the majority, some of whom do not follow perhaps the way that we view the world, but that in doing that work, we become that much more that perfect union. And we also happen to advance the minority interests that we care about most. Most readily, but that does require first admitting, I believe, as Stacey Abrams was trying to indicate, as someone who was minority leader in Georgia, in a rural state, as a black African American, beautiful, brilliant woman, who this does not look, though, to be frank, as she has acknowledged herself, right, the way that most people assume someone, quote unquote, should look, whatever the heck that's supposed to mean, right, as someone running for office. And all of that to say that despite that, you still have to find a way to work with people who are across the aisle, who look different from you, who may talk different from you, who may think different from you, who may share different beliefs from you. But in that working, and if you can find common ground, then we will realize ultimately that that is how change is made.
You know, one of the things that is critical to this discussion and part and parcel of what Yvonne brought up, because she talked about Anita Hill. She didn't like the way that Joe Biden treated Anita Hill. And, of course, we were talking about all of that happening during the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. Well, as we know, right now we have found out that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in the hospital again. And she is 87 years old. And for those who like the way that she makes decisions and are supporters of the legal judgment that she has exercised, and let's be frank, 87 is she's old, and her age is, and her health is fragile. She's battling an infection. The reporting is that she should be in for 3 days or so. She's a multiple cancer survivor. Even if you have questions about how Joe Biden supported Anita Hill or did not support or treated Anita Hill. This news about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and who will be making decisions about who is on the Supreme Court go to the very heart of how significant the vote is, Dr. Perry.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't disagree with you anymore. The reality is we don't have the luxury as people of color to be one issue voters. We just simply don't. There's too much at stake for us in every single election because we are disenfranchised legally in this country, because we have been mass incarcerated, over-incarcerated. That was a deliberate political ploy, as we've known from, you know, Nixon administration officials to have said on tape, you know, to have been victims deliberately of the targeting of Russia, a foreign country to this day that still has not taken responsibility, because we have not held them responsible because our current president refuses to do so for reasons that apparently we won't find out until his tax returns are probably ever released after he is out of office. But the Russia attacked African-Americans of all the groups who attacked primarily via their cyber war campaign in the 2016 election. They chose black folks. And so that should be a warning signal to every black person. And remember, first and foremost, that this is not just an election about Biden and Trump. First of all, Trump was endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan official newspaper. And so every black person, presumably, is not a friend of the KKK. And if you don't want that type of ideology to be replicated for another 4 years, and we've seen what that has produced, then the option for most African Americans has to be somewhat clear.
Talk to me a little bit about voter suppression in this sense. Do voters understand what it looks like, particularly when the voting processes vary from state to state? And how can I, as a voter, understand or be aware when there are attempts to suppress my vote?
The fact that as a African American, you are being suppressed should tell us that our vote matters. You don't try to suppress people who don't matter. You don't try to suppress folks who, when they have proven by their mass mobilization in the past to have gone out and voted in mass numbers during key elections, that has often been the voice and backbone, moral conscience of this country, and has saved it from disaster time and time again. Unfortunately, we did not do that in 2016, in part because it was the first election that we had since the really completely near eradication of the Voting Rights Act, and so by the Supreme Court, in that we did not have full protection. So that was one problem. On top of the clear GOP-controlled state and county level voter disenfranchisement, everything from closing of polls early to putting up roadblocks sponsored by state police patrols. All those things certainly played a role. But what also played a role is that many African Americans were in fact duped on our social media pages, in our accounts, on our phones, perhaps hacked in ways that we did not know, may have happened inadvertently, but nonetheless, millions of us clicked on the kinds of things that clearly had some type of influence that was successful, and that those messages from Russia was trying to encourage us to either not vote at all, vote for Jill Stein, or vote for Donald Trump. But whatever you do, do not vote for Hillary Clinton. And many African Americans, frankly, fell for that. And yes, there's the other segment of the black community that had legitimate and deep-seated concerns about the candidacy of Hillary Clinton and therefore what her presidency would look like. And all of that considered,
led to the disaster that we're in today. However, had we in 2016 been as monolithically responsive in terms of our voter turnout toward to a president that was presidential candidate that was endorsed by the KKK, as we have been, for example, on social media recently in Black Twitter and responding so cohesively and consistently as a community against the Kanye West purported presidential announcement, if we can galvanize for that, then we certainly should be able to galvanize together and recognize that this election in this coming November is less about Biden and Trump than it is about defeating a dangerous white supremacist ideology, that if we do not play the role that we have with the shoes that we have paved with our blood, sweat, and tears to actually cast votes in November, if we don't take that opportunity and we allow this white supremacist ideology to spread, we will have no one to blame at that point other than ourselves.
Stacey Abrams said she was not confident in what justice will look like in the Ahmaud Arbery case. And whether it's Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, all of them different and the same, are you confident about what justice may look like in the Arbery case or the Floyd case or the Breonna Taylor case?
Confident, no. Hopeful, yes. I mean, ultimately, our justice system can work and has worked, even given its fundamental flaws at its core. And it certainly it needs a complete overhaul and a complete revamp that certainly doesn't privilege the arresting of Black and brown people for petty crimes and then disproportionately attacking aggressively long sentences and then thereafter parole violations on them as well. But that notwithstanding, we have an opportunity to understand that when we are able to think about the power of participating in our criminal justice dialogue through protest, and that gains attention, and that attention, like Stacey Abrams was talking about, that is now on the Arbery case there in Georgia, that attention helps. It helps to ensure that maybe justice will in fact happen. It's sad that in this country it has often taken attention of the public in order for justice to in fact happen. But it happened in the 1960s where King and so many other leaders always articulated that it was television that began to show the Birmingham Children's March, for example, and other marches of kids being thrown across streets with water hoses from firefighters and getting dogs sick on their ankles simply for walking for basic rights. For to be able to, for example, drink out of a water fountain, God forbid, that, you know, did not have a colored sign in front of it. And so this is the context in which protest plays a key role in ensuring that some attention stays on these cases. But we have to remember carefully to not limit our activism to the news cycle. If we as a community only respond to that which comes across our news feed, that which comes across our email, that which is talked about on TV or on the radio, if we are going to only respond to those cases, then we've already lost. Because if we believe that this is structural and systemic, then we also know that there are thousands of people whose names we will never know, who are victims of the same system, and they deserve just as much justice and attention, even if the lights and cameras are not on them.
When I asked her about the term a cold civil war, she said she pushed back on that term and said she believes that we are in the midst of a reckoning. And yet, today, President Trump, just an hour or so ago, was talking about support of a Civil War symbol, the Confederate flag, and talking about freedom of speech. Do you think she's right? Are we in the midst of a reckoning? Is this a cold Civil War, six of one, half dozen of the other? What do you say?
I'm not so sure the rhetoric of Cold War is useful, only because for people who happen to live through it, even as someone like myself who was young but certainly understood what it was about, it doesn't, of course, bring back any positive memories. Despite the so-called Republican victory and their adoration of Ronald Reagan and tearing down the wall, et cetera. These are the kinds of, I think, moments that, Americans, some have chosen to create in terms of our experience with the Cold War. The reality is, I think that this is a simple conversation.
Well, I said cold civil, Cold Civil War.
Oh, Cold Civil War.
Cold Civil War.
So I would say, only reason why I would say no is because I think the concept of racial discourse in our language, in our laws, in our practices, on the streets, and in these violent actions, certainly by police toward African Americans, that ultimately the level of violent attack, as horrible and horrific it has been, has not produced anywhere at this point near the level of trauma the Civil War did in fact place on this country. Is it certainly a reckoning, as Stacey Abrams has indicated? Yes. Do I believe we may have some type of a re-emergent cold cyber war with Russia? That certainly seems plausible. But in terms of our racial interactions with each other, because our public school efforts, largely again controlled by Republican-led state governors who appoint members of the state boards of education, who then, of course, set curriculum in your local school district where you live, those experiences have served over the last several decades, while Democrats were focusing on national politics and Republicans were spending a lot of time on state and local politics, that type of whittling down of education has served to create a moment today in our country where we don't know much about each other. We don't understand what Native Americans have done and the contributions and sacrifices they have made and why most of them are in Oklahoma. We don't understand necessarily how immigrants who are not white from Europe got here to this country and how what they're fleeing from perhaps matters just as much. We don't understand, obviously, the experiences of African Americans, of black people of all stripes and backgrounds who happen to live in this country now, who are making contributions day in and day out. And we have the opportunity to, I think, to change the conversation and the narrative. And instead of us engaging in any type of dialogue that might further any notions or rhetoric towards some type of a cold civil war or cold war of any kind that suggests a latent kind of underneath the surface fissure in between groups, I think we should take those opportunities that instead turn the conversation around and try to bring people together, because we do ultimately have more in common as Americans than we do apart as racial, ethnic, and otherwise distinct groups.
And one more thing that I think we should mention before we close out this conversation quickly. She did mention the 2020 census. It is not over. And as a matter of fact, it is quite possible that as soon as this week, many households that have not responded will be hearing from federal government staff to help complete this. And this process is going to go on between now and October. So we've got to make sure that we show up in the 2020 census. Dr. Ravi Perry, thank you so much for talking to us. Stay safe. I appreciate your time.
Same to you. Take care.
All right, that is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, July 14th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.